Morning, everybody. If anybody else is out in the waiting room, if you could come on in, we'll get started. This morning, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Sean Baca, who's a rheumatologist practicing here in Boca Raton. Dr. Baca went to the University of New Mexico for his medical school and then got smart and came to Miami, where he did his training. He did his internship at Mount Sinai and his residency there, and then did his fellowship in rheumatology at the University of Miami. And Dr. Baca is a very well-respected rheumatologist who's enjoyed teaching many of our students for many years.
Okay, we'll get started here. Okay, so let's see. Okay, so I don't have any disclosures for this talk. So we're going to do this today. We're going to talk about the medical impact of osteoporosis. We're going to talk about risk factors associated with it. We're also going to talk about treatment prevention of osteoporosis and controversies in osteoporosis management. Last time I did this lecture was, can you hear me? Nope. Last time I did this lecture was a few years ago, and I've actually changed quite a bit of this lecture, and it changes quite a bit. When I first started, essentially all we had was human calcitonin. We were experimenting with gallium nitrate, and that was about it. And now we have this plethora of medications. And there are actually several that are coming down the pike also. And we've made, you know, large strides in treating this illness. So the definition of osteoporosis basically is it's a skeletal disorder that's characterized by compromised bone strength. So we essentially equate bone strength with density, which is what we normally measure. But we can't measure easily architecture. For example, you know, how are the trabeculae situated, et cetera, because you really need both of these in order to have a good bone quality and bone strength. So conceptually, the idea is that as you age, what happens is that you lose structure. So you have lateral struts, horizontal struts, and basically just like the struts in a chair, this gives you quite a bit of strength. What will happen is over time, these horizontal struts and then eventually the vertical struts will start breaking down. And what happens is that you develop fragility of the bone. So bone is composed of organic and inorganic materials. The organic portion is basically mostly collagen. A portion of it is, the cellular component is basically osteoclasts and osteoblasts. And the inorganic portion is mostly hydroxyapatite, which is 2/3 of its mass. The bone is organized in cortical bone, which is the outside, and the trabecular bone, which is the inside. So you remember this from medical school, and basically you have your classic conversion canals. You have basically blood channels that go through the cortical bone, and then the trabecular side is basically more porous. This is where your marrow is. And then the outside is basically where you get most of your strength and rigidity. The inside gives you a little bit of flexibility because the bones have to flex a tiny bit. Because if they don't, then, you know, essentially what they could do is they could shatter under high-impact activities. So you need a little bit of both. Okay so the NORA study, which basically was a risk assessment from North America, basically determined that looking at bone densities is appropriate, and that lower bone density is associated with higher fracture rates. Now, what I want to highlight here, and this is what I want you to remember from this lecture, is that 50% of all osteoporotic fractures occur in osteopenic patients, not patients with osteoporosis. And the problem is we're missing this group. And the failure of that basically, of course, increases societal costs and personal costs. So what the NORA did was is they took a normal bell-shaped curve, and they took data from thousands of patients, and they took their bone densities. And these are patients who are basically considered of normal age. So they use usually somewhere in the late 30s, 40s is hopefully peak bone mass. And then they plot this out. And what they did was they determined that at the bottom portion that we're going to call this osteoporosis, and from here to here osteopenia, and from here to here normal. Okay. Now the problem is that you can see that the fracture rates, of course, go up with time, and of course they don't go up in a stepwise fashion. In other words, there's nothing magic about this number that says that only people with osteoporotic fracture and osteopenic people don't fracture. That, you know, you can see that it basically it's a progression like anything else. And so we need to make sure that we take care of this group and not over-treat this group and definitely treat this group. So what happens? Typically, your first fracture is usually vertebral. And then it's assumed that 10 years later, after a vertebral fracture, patients start increasing their risk of hip fractures. So this is important because 2/3 of all vertebral fractures are asymptomatic. And that's another thing I want you guys to remember, is that most fractures are not symptomatic. Now, these things are missed. If you look at studies, they will look at studies of radiology, they'll look at studies of people having chest X, et cetera, that somewhere in the proportion of maybe 10 to 20% of patients who have fractures on a chest X-ray are even reported on the chest X-ray, because people assume that this is aging. They just assume that this is just part of life, and basically these things don't get reported. And automatically, if you have a Fragile fracture, you automatically have osteoporosis, whether you have osteopenia or not, and you should be treated more aggressively, because a few years later, now you're going to go for the big ticket items and start breaking hips. So what's the impact of osteoporosis? We have over 2 million fractures in men and women over 1 year. Of them, the majority are vertebral. But you can see hip fractures are fairly substantial, wrist fractures, and then other non-vertebral fractures. So that can include collarbones. Now, whenever you're looking at person's risk, what you do is you look at certain bones. You look at wrist, you look at shoulder, collarbone, vertebral, pelvic, hip. You don't count necessarily an ankle fracture or a foot fracture as being osteoporotic, although we do see more fractures in that group. And the assumption is because those are usually higher trauma fractures. Often when a person falls, there's a rotational action with it, and so it puts a lot of stress in the bone. So sometimes normal people can have fractures with foot and ankle stuff with normal bone density. So when we talk about fragility fractures, we're going to limit it to those other groups that we just talked about. So the incidence of osteoporosis is approximately 10 million patients. We have 33.6 million that are considered to have low bone density or osteopenia. So you can see this number is much bigger than this number. As we said, the fracture rates are less in the osteopenic group, but they're not zero either. So when you multiply a very large number by a smaller number, you still get a very big number. And again, that's why we have to remember that 50% of your fractures, your fragility fractures, occur in the osteopenic group. So one out of two females will have a fracture at some time in their life, and approximately one in five men. So when you think about this, this is past epidemic. 50% of women don't get breast cancer. Heart attacks, et cetera, et cetera. So by far, this is probably, target number one for a lot of things, and this is the low-hanging fruit. So what's the economic toll? You have over 400,000 hospital admissions. You have 2.5 million doctor office visits. I think I did half of them last week. At least it seemed like that in the office. 180,000 hospital nursing home admissions. And the cost in 2005 was $17 billion, and it's predicted to go up to $25 billion by 2025. Hip fractures result anywhere from an 8 to 30% increase in excess mortality. Now, the big problem with this is it's not a sexy disease like a heart attack. You drop dead, boom, you're done. Okay, it's very dramatic. When you break a hip, you go to the hospital. You might throw an embolism. You might, get an infection and have to call Dr. Wiese. You need surgery. You need anesthesia. And then what happens is you're weak, and then you've got to go to the nursing home. And then what happens is you fall again, et cetera, et cetera. So we've all seen patients. This is going to be the beginning of the end. So if you're over 80, the risk is about 20% death rate if you break your hip within a year. So when you look at it, that's a pretty big deal. And there is an increased mortality even with vertebral fractures. I remember specifically having a lady who had a pelvic fracture, And, you know, with vertebral fractures, at least you can do something. You can do a vertebroplasty. You can do something to alleviate their pain. But pelvic fractures are miserable because there's nothing you can do for them. You don't fix them surgically. You just basically sit there. You give them lots of morphine or some type of pain medication. And then basically they just get constipated. They're miserable. And, you know, my particular lady expired suddenly. And I assume that probably what happened was she probably threw a clot or an embolism at home. So vertebral fractures can cause also chronic complications. Patients develop a kyphosis. They start developing more arthritis. You can often sometimes, especially if the fractures migrate a little bit, you can get more spinal stenosis. You can develop chest bellows disease. I had a lady once who literally had her chin sitting in her belly button. This was in the calcitonin era, when pre-Fosamax. And she literally had her chin sitting above her belly button and did die, actually, of a respiratory infection. Lumbar fractures, of course, also can affect the abdominal anatomy and more obstipation, distension, early satiety. And, of course, wrist fractures or shoulder fractures, often you get chronic damage from that. For example, you know, a portion of patients with shoulder fractures will develop AVN and permanent arthritis, won't be able to lift their shoulders up. Same thing with hips. You know, a large portion of patients who have hip replacements are going to end up having to have a second surgery, a hip repair, going to have a hip replacement down the road because they develop AVN of the fractured hip. So this is only in women. Okay, so you have 1.6 million fractures in females per year. And this is the incidence of stroke, heart attack, and breast cancer. And now this is the incident of breast cancer. So if we take this, just looking at the hip fractures alone, if you take 250,000 hip fractures, basically you multiply that approximately 20%, you're getting a number somewhere in the 40,000 range per deaths per year. And that's just from hip fractures. It doesn't include the other ones. Breast cancer death rate's about 20-some-odd thousand per year in this country. So actually, more people die of osteoporosis-related issues than you do of breast cancer. And again, we pay lots of attention to this, which we should, but we don't pay enough attention to this. And this is a lot cheaper to treat. So this is a percentage of people who do not get treated. So looking at Medicare data, and this is from 2000, this has improved, but I promise you these numbers have not improved that much. This may not be true for Boca, because it seems like everybody knows how to bone density down here, because you guys are all doing a good job, and Dr. Rubin doesn't let anybody get out of his office without all their health maintenance. But what you're looking at is a large proportion of patients based on Medicare data who are eligible for bone densities have never had one their entire life, okay? Patients have had fractures, still don't get bone densities, very few, you know, still the prescriptions for calcium are low, and vitamin D is hardly ever prescribed. Now, this is looking at bisphosphonates, but at the time this was done, that was the only, you know, treatment. So you're seeing that, you know, even a higher proportion of patients aren't being treated. So what are the risk factors? So the National Osteoporosis Foundation basically lists major and minor, major risk factors as being a personal history of fracture. Remember, vertebral fractures equal fractures of the hip or something else down the road, history of a first-degree relative having a fracture, low body mass, smoking, corticosteroids, and, of course, the things that increase your risk of falling, okay? So impaired vision, frailty, dementia, falls themselves, and then, of course, nutritional things and low physical activity and booze. So these are the secondary causes of osteoporosis, and I promise you this list is not comprehensive. There's still lots of other things. Not something to memorize, but just realize that they're basically issues with pretty much every illness. The only thing was, you know, as far as hyperparathyroidism, you got primary and secondary. But, you know, we see a lot of androgen deficiencies in males, the hematologic. Myeloma, of course, which is something common. I usually will do an SPEP in pretty much everybody's workup. But also, I had a patient recently had systemic mastocytosis that presented as osteoporosis. Dietary things, of course, are an issue, and high caffeine also. And with renal bone disease, you really shouldn't consider that osteoporosis because that's a different state. That's a high parathyroid state, usually induced by low vitamin D because of the inability to convert 25 to 125D. And typically, these patients have very high phosphorus levels. So we're not going to discuss that today. Hypercalciuria is very common. I pick this up probably at least once a week. And then, of course, OGI, glycogen storage disease, and rheumatic patients with chronic inflammation are at higher risk of infection, osteoporosis, as well as patients who have inflammatory bowel disease. So with medications associated with bone loss, just want to highlight a few. Heparin we know about, but very few people take it for very long. But Coumadin is associated with bone loss. Of course, cancer chemotherapeutic agents are, and a lot of our patients have been previously treated. Anticonvulsants such as Dilantin, which is used less. Some of the psychiatric medications. A big thing with us is aromatase inhibitors to treat breast cancer, and of course, corticosteroids and thyroid medication. And when patients take thyroid, often, I always encourage them to take the least needed dose, even though patients like to be peppier and try to, you know, drive their numbers, higher. We really want them in the middle because excessive thyroid or hyperthyroidism increases your risk of bone loss. Now, what I want you to take home from this is, of course, we know that steroids are bad for your bones, but look at 2.5 milligrams per day substantially increases your risk of fracture, okay? It doesn't take much steroid to do it. Even tiny doses do it. Typically, in the books, they usually tell you 2.5, 7.5 you should consider treating, but when you look at it, especially if our patients are frail or low densities, they probably should all be prophylaxed if they're on chronic steroids, even at low dose. So the quantifiable risk factors can be helpful in identifying patients who are at risk of fracture. So let's talk a little bit about DEXA testing. Okay, these are from the most current guidelines. And what they're stating is that females of 65 or older, if they have no risk factors, should be scanned. And males 70 or older should be scanned. Now, this is the key. How many men do you know have had a bone density scans? I mean, every male that I see in the office who over 70 will get a scan. But majority of males don't get done, okay? And in postmenopausal people, i.e. over 50, if there are any risk factors, then basically you'll test. Do you have a male that's hypogonadal? You test. If you have a female who's maybe on steroids, has got rheumatoid arthritis, et cetera, you test at 50. So majority of people I see are usually in this group because they're usually high risk. But so the problem is that if you look at the U.S. Task Force guidelines, which are really, in my opinion, garbage, what they stated was is that you do your first bone density at 65 and you do second at 80, okay? So somebody challenged them, which is, which nobody does nowadays, but, you need to challenge these people because they're putting out this stuff that's just garbage. And so he said, okay, well, following your guidelines, let's go ahead and look at what happened. It turns out that 80% of patients had osteoporosis have been missed by following their guidelines. So, basically, you're still the doctor, you're still the clinician, you need to make the decisions based on what you think is right for your patient and not based on these guidelines. And also depends on whose guidelines. But these are the ones that typically people are following. So the measurements of BMD, we saw that Nora bell-shaped curve. And essentially anything from minus 1 and above is considered normal. Osteopenia or low bone mass is minus 1 to minus 2.5, and osteoporosis is minus 2.5. We don't really use this term severe osteoporosis, but what they're stating is 2.5 with a fracture. This terminology is pretty much going away, but this is from 98. Whenever you do see a bone density report from a hospital or somewhere else, if they mention the word severe osteoporosis, to be honest, that's kind of silly too because it's like a little pregnant. You're already in the minus 2.5 standard deviations from the norm, which means only you're in the bottom 5 percentile. You're already bad, okay? You don't need to be any worse than that. So T-scores, what they are is that's the score that you get, minus 2.5, 2.1, and what that is basically it's a standard deviation from the mean. So, again, using a normal, healthy adult population is how that score was taken, and it describes your individual risk. Now, what you may not know is the Z-score, and that's the number that's in the box right to the right of it. And what the Z-score tells you is when you're compared to your same age group, okay, because the T-score is compared to the 40-year-old. So if you have somebody who has a Z-score of zero and they're 80 years old, they can still have a low bone mass. But what it's telling you is that they're not falling off the curve. Think of it like a growth curve that you'd have with babies. And essentially, if their Z-scores are low and their T-scores are low, they probably have a metabolic bone disease. There's something else going on because they're not following the normal progression that most people do. So the diagnosis is based on osteoporosis and any site. So if you have a site that has osteoporosis, you have osteoporosis. So if you're minus 2.4 in the spine and minus 2.6 in the hip, it's osteoporosis. The problem is that sometimes you also see reports that say the patient has osteopenia and osteoporosis. There's no such thing. It's, again, like being a little pregnant. Either you have it or you don't. You go based on the worst number because you're going to treat based on the worst numbers. So if a patient has a fragility fracture, and this is also very important, and they have a low bone mass or osteopenia, they still have osteoporosis. So you don't write down in your chart the patient has osteopenia. They're 2.4, but they broke their back. They have osteoporosis. Okay, and that's very important because you're going to need that for treatment sometimes, because otherwise insurance companies will refuse treatment on patients if they look strictly at the bone density. And again, not using, you know, our clinical judgment, looking at the entire patient. So hip densities. The femoral bone density is most predictive of fracture. Okay, we don't use the Ward triangle. That's kind of an old research tool that's been on there forever. You still see them in the reports. And you'll see the Wards is like -3 and the hip is -2. Just ignore the Wards, because the bottom line is that it just overstates the bone loss, and it just should not be used. And the total hip bone density is important because that's what you compare between scans, because the total is an average of three or four different sites. So what you can sometimes see is the neck goes up between year 2010 and 2012, but the total went down. What you do is you go total to total. You never go neck to neck when you're comparing scans. Okay, but again, I see a lot of bone densities that some institutions that read them incorrectly, and they compare neck to neck, and that's not what you're supposed to do, because you want an average, because sometimes one will go up, the triangle will go down, this will go up and that, and then what you do is you can wash out the numbers. So a total will give you a much better assessment of what's going on. The spinal densities, we've all seen this. They can have a falsely higher number because patients get osteoarthritis as well, and they get spurring, and they get scoliosis, et cetera, et cetera. Or if they've had a fracture, what happens? Again, you're compressing everything, so you've just basically de facto increased your density. So if you see a -2.5, you know, hip and a -1 spine, you probably just have osteoarthritis, and you don't look at the spine as seriously. Follow-ups generally recommended about every 2 years if you're on therapy, but you might want to do them in a year if you're doing something. For example, patient's going down, I start a new therapy, and I need to know if this therapy is at least working, at least keeping them from going down, because I might potentially, especially if I'm on a lower drug, I might want to put them on something stronger, then you might want to do it at a year. Problem is that Medicare is not going to pay it 1 year, but to tell you the truth, bone density is so cheap, it costs probably the price of a nice entree somewhere, that it makes sense that they probably should just do it, because you're spending thousands of dollars on their medication sometimes, so to avoid doing a $35 test is kind of a little silly. But, you know, that sometimes patients, you know, think about these crazy things. You can't compare scans from different manufacturers. That's a big deal, because people often are Hologic machines or Lunar machines, and you want to compare to the others. Whenever people send me scans from their office, I always try to make sure that we send them back to the same scanner. Okay, we never try to change scanners, because the problem is that the variation between scans is different. And even if you have the same system, what you do is when you fire up your machine, what you do is you have a blank or a standard that you use for your machine to calibrate it, and everybody's calibrator is a physical device, and therefore everyone's a little different. So unless you cross-calibrate with the same device and drive the same device to everybody's machine every day, you're going to have some drift in the numbers. So again, you really want to be on the same machine if possible, okay? And if you can't do that, then at least you try to be in the same type of machine so you can compare the numbers directly when possible. So the NOF guidelines, basically you want to treat patients who have scores of -2.5 in the hip or spine. If they've had a previous fracture, they should be treated. And then if they are considered to having an increased risk in these patients who are osteopenic but higher risk, What you're going to do is look at something called the FRAX or FRAX tool. And if they're greater than 20% of any non-vertebral fracture, greater than 3% of the hip, you should be they should be treated. Okay. So the FRAX, you go on. I have it on my laptop, and I just have a little icon there. And when I see the patient, if it's not reported, I'll just calculate it right there in the room with the patient. And basically what it does is you put in things such as their age, weight, height, and whether or not they're taking steroids, or how much they drink, et cetera. And then if they've had family history of fracture, you put in the actual femoral neck score, what machine it is, Logic Lunar, and then it spits out a number. And then that's helpful. The only issue, again, is that, you know, it does, you know, somewhat devalue the clinical process in terms of, you know, using it as a strict guideline, you know, but it does at least helps you, and sometimes it helps convince the patient that you need to be treated. And probably more likely than, you know, the patient probably has a very high FRAX number, but when you can show them something, says, look, you're minus 2.4, you know, your bone density is getting worse. It's crazy to wait until you get worse and wait till the next scan. Here's the number, and this says you should be treated. Sometimes it's very helpful to have that in the room with you. Now, the problem is that it's somewhat based in cost containment because, again, they're saying a 20% risk of fracture over 10 years is acceptable. You know, in Boca Raton, it may not be. Okay, it might be somewhere else. And so, you know, again, you know, cultural, et cetera, but this is based on cost containment. And when the FRAX guidelines were first set up, this was when alendronate was still a name brand. Now you can get it for about $5 a month. So it's really hard to make the argument, you know, to base these things strictly on, you know, cost containment. They should be really more based on what's best for the patient and efficacious and safe. So this is what you get. And basically just plug in the numbers and you hit the little key, and then what it'll do is it'll give you some numbers. So this patient here is at 18% and 1.8. So we're going to treat or not treat. Can't hear anybody. Residents?
Not treat.
Not, correct. Okay, so how do you evaluate a patient with low bone mass? First of all, this is a fairly basic metabolic workup. I do this on pretty much everybody. And what you want to do is, of course, you want the vitamin D, calcium, phosphorus levels. But what we also want to do is we want to get a 24-hour urine calcium. And especially these are the patients with the low Z-scores. Because you want to know if they have hypercalciuria. If they're older patients, often we'll get an S-PEP. We want to look for monoclonal proteins. If they've not had a thyroid done in a while, you should do one. And if they, if you're concerned at all, you probably should do a cortisol level, you know, increased, especially in a heavier person who comes in with osteoporosis. I usually like to get a bone-specific ELK-FOS, which measures anabolism. And a CTX basically measures catabolism, so you're looking at proteins from degradation. This can help you sometimes, in especially following patients, if you're going to continue treatment, not continue treatment, et cetera. And then if you have other risk factors for other things, you're concerned about hemochromatosis, et cetera, then you're going to add some other tests. But that's the basic workup. Then you're going to discuss lifestyle issues, how much do you drink, how much do you smoke, how much do you exercise. Do you eat enough? And, you know, in this particular group, often these patients are thinner, so we're doing the exact opposite and trying to convince them to eat more protein and actually put a little weight on. And then you'll discuss fall prevention at home. You know, they get up to pee at night. Do you turn on the light? Do you have slippy rugs in the house? Do you have a grab bar in the shower? Because, you know, this, again, is the easy thing to do. You know, just try not to break in the first place by not falling. So imaging. You want to do a lateral x-ray if the patient's had a previous fracture or a significant height loss. And one of the things that they ask at a basic, doctor visit, you know, just primary care doctor visit, is you really should try at least annually or every other year to get the patient's height, because that's very suggestive of issues. And if they've lost, you know, 2 to 3 inches, you should do something about it. The only problem with doing something like that is you really should have a stadiometer, because usually the one on your scale usually doesn't work that well. And secondly, everybody over-exaggerates how good they used to be when they were younger. So, okay, morphometry is the lateral DEXA. It's not reimbursed in some places. Sometimes it's helpful because you can follow patients from year to year, and they can do is they can draw a little cursor marks around the bones and actually see if the volume's decreased over time. And so that gives you another helpful tool. So, for example, let's say the bone density in the hip went down, but it went up in the spine, and the morphometric test shows that the bones are actually contracting. Then you say, look, your treatment's not working. The only reason your spine went up is because you're actually shrinking more, meaning you're still compressing. So that can be helpful in that situation. So male patients, the special considerations are a lot of our patients have prostate cancer, so a lot of them are on some type of androgen deprivation therapy, or they may have had surgery, orchiectomies, et cetera. And so these patients probably should be scanned more regularly. Some of the urologists now are routinely scanning all their prostate cancer patients, which they should. And then we can start therapy earlier. If you have a younger male patient, consider testosterone deficiency. So that should be part of your basic workup. And basically, again, the NOF recommends that all males over 70 should have a bone density. Now, this is the rub. Medicare won't pay for the scan unless it's positive. But you don't know if it's positive unless you do the scan. It's your wacky government again, okay? So this is what it is. And again, we're talking about $40 here, literally, okay? We're talking about $40, and they're going to hockey over that, but they'll pay thousands of dollars for some medication without batting an eye, okay? So this is our problem. Okay, so prevention and treatment options. So basically you have anabolic therapy, you have antiresorptive therapy. Of course, you want to use calcium and vitamin D. And, of course, you want to discuss lifestyle issues, fall prevention, et cetera. So all these three things basically work together to hopefully prevent or reduce the risk of fractures. So what are the non-pharmacologic things, common sense things? Assisted devices, canes and walkers, grab bars if necessary. Weight-bearing exercise, very important. Balanced posture exercises, Tai Chi-type stuff is very good. You know, it's interesting. I was in China, and, you know, all the older folks go to the park, and they do their Tai Chi and all this other stuff, and I thought that was really cool. And then you realize they all live in apartments that are probably about this big, and they have 27 families living in them. And basically, the wife kicks the husband out of the house as soon as daylight comes to get some space, and you go to the park and go exercise, and then the wife goes at a different time. If you notice, the men and women don't exercise at the same time. It's so they can get away from each other. So, okay, so anyway, so you also want to avoid sedatives if possible at night. You know, we have a lot of patients that are, you know, have to have their Ambien or whatever. It's like you really try your best to try to keep them from doing these kinds of things because that increases your risk of falling, of course. Calcium recommendations, basically 50 or younger, basically about 1,000 milligrams a day. So you young ladies in the audience, you should be having some calcium in your diet. At 1,200 if you're 50 or older. And basically for males, it's 1,000. And this has changed since the last time I did it. Now they're recommending that males are 70, older than 70 should have 1,200. It used to be just 1,000 flat for males, period. And now that's gone up to the same as the females. So how do you calculate your calcium intake? This is actually a good thing to have with the patients. Basically, for every dairy product, essentially getting about 300 milligrams of calcium. You add up their medications, how much you're taking in your calcium supplements, and then any fortified stuff. Because a lot of people nowadays are taking almond milk and, you know, rice milk, etc. They're getting the orange juice with calcium. And then basically you can add maybe 250 milligrams for just insensible things, and then you get your total. And then you take that number, and then you add the supplements. It's nice to get it nutritionally, and we prefer patients to get their calcium nutritionally. But if they don't, because they're worried about their calories, et cetera, then you add the pills here. One thing that I want to discuss is that, you know, patients are all taking PPIs now. And when I grew up, when a patient had anemia, it's because they were bleeding. They had a GI bleed, they were taking an NSAID, had erosive gastritis, whatever. Now, every time I see somebody with iron deficiency, it's because they're taking PPIs. Almost every single time. We see very little GI bleeding. We don't see stress ulcers. I mean, George can probably remember that. You know, when we were residents and people came to the hospital and they're in the ICU, they had these stress ulcers and just like vomit all blood all over you and they'd be dead in 10 minutes. We just don't see that anymore because of PPIs. But the problem is that they also interfere with the transport of ions across the stomach membrane, and therefore what's happening is you're not absorbing your iron or your calcium, okay? So if patients are in PPI, they should be on calcium citrate, not calcium carbonate, because with carbonate requires acid to break it up in order for the cation to be actually absorbed. So do not give patients calcium carbonate if they're on a PPI, okay? Probably doesn't matter so much with H2 blockers, but calcium citrate is very important. The thing to remember about calcium citrate is when it comes in the bottle, it's two pills for one serving. So in other words, it says 630 milligrams, and if you read in the very fine print that nobody can read, it says two pills equals 630, because your traditional caltrate's 600 per pill, because the citrate makes the pill volume bigger, and they can't make a pill that big. The second thing is they got to look at the label again carefully, because they just came out, because Mission just sold Citracal brand to Bayer Aspirin, and guess what they did? Is they made a slow release. And patients are saying, oh, it's wonderful. I take two pills. It's done for the day. It releases very slowly. You know what they did to make the pill smaller? They took mostly calcium citrate out of it and put calcium carbonate on it, but they still call it Citracal. Okay, so if they're going to do Citracal, make sure that they're taking the petites or they're taking the maximums and not the slow release. So, again, you got to read the label. Okay, calcium malate is okay. The acidified calciums are okay with patients on the PPI as well. But the carbonates... basically try to avoid them. And if I see somebody who comes in with a very low bone mass, they've been on calcium previously, I usually try to convince them to change. If they want to get fancy, you can go to the health food store, you can get the gummy bears, you can get the liquids, you can get all the other stuff. But, you know, you can get at the Walgreens, you know, standard calcium citrate or the store brand, and they're not too much. Okay, they're a little more expensive, though. And that's one of the reasons why patients usually buy the carbonates, just because they save a dollar or two here. You know, but, you know, again, you want to discourage that if possible. So how do we prevent things? First of all, we use our non-pharmacologic interventions that we discussed. And then we can talk about estrogen or oral bisphosphonates or serums. Now, what's important is that they're all approved for prevention, but they're also underprescribed. Estrogen, obviously, you know, you have your debate and your plus and minuses, but oral bisphosphonates, when you think about them, they're very cheap. And what I try to do is if I have somebody who I think is at fairly high risk, but their bone density is really not so bad, and their Frax tool isn't so bad, and this is, again, my personal opinion, but this is what I do, and I think I have pretty good results, is I might actually put them on bisphosphonate early. Because remember, when you start menopause, you start that very rapid drop. So it makes more sense to hit them at the peak. You only need to treat them for 2 or 3 years. The bisphosphonate will hang around for a long time, and they don't make that quick drop, you know, to minus two something. And then you can basically just not do anything except give them calcium, vitamin D, and then wait till they drop again, treat them, then take them off for a few years and back and forth, rather than waiting till they crash down here. And then if you're lucky, you can raise their bone density maybe 1% or 2% per year. Okay. But unfortunately, I'm a little bit in the minority in that opinion right now. But again, these drugs are cheap, and I think in the long run, people will take a lot less drugs if you treat them earlier for shorter periods of time and then follow them. Because remember, 50% of women have fractures. So tell me what penetrance of any other disease that you know is 50% in this country, and we're just not doing a good job at preventing this. So, and if you have a patient who you think is high risk, look at the Frax calculation, and sometimes I can help you also decide. If you're close, maybe 18%, you might want to do it. If you're 2 to 3%, you probably don't need to think about it. Okay, so as far as the pharmacologic options, you have anti-resorptive therapy and anabolic therapy. So the purpose of anti-resorptive therapy basically is to wipe out the osteoclasts, the bone-eating cells. The purpose of anabolic therapy is to increase the osteoblastic activity. So we have various drugs that do that. Basically, all the hormone-type medications do that, calcitonin, bisphosphonates, and now, of course, denosumab or Prolia. These are all basically anti-resorptive therapies. And the anabolic therapy is basically the PTH analogs, okay? Now, PTH is an interesting story because we all know that patients with hyperparathyroidism have a low bone mass, and you think, that's kind of crazy. Why are we getting PTH? Well, the reason is because you're giving them in short amounts. and you're basically pulsing it. So they're only having a high PTH level in their blood for a few hours, and then it comes back down. So it's not the same thing as a patient with primary hyperparathyroidism or renal bone disease. You're pulsing for a little bit, and then it comes back down to normal, and that's what causes anabolic cycle. It's that fluctuation of high to low levels of the PTH. If you gave them constant PTH, what happens is that you would actually lose that effect very quickly. So as far as hormone replacement therapy and serums, a serum would be raloxifene. Basically, what they do is they work by the estrogen receptors. They decrease bone turnover. They reduce the risk of vertebral fractures about 30%. What I want you to remember, too, is one of the pearls from this lecture is estrogen is not approved for treating osteoporosis. It's only approved for prevention. Now, the reason this is confusing is because it used to be approved for treatment and prevention, and now it's only for prevention, okay? But the serums are approved for both, okay? Neither will reduce your risk of hip fracture very much. They're mostly for vertebral fractures. So these are drugs you're going to use kind of early on. Maybe if you don't want to give the patient a bisphosphonate, especially if you have an early menopause, maybe you want to give them an estrogen. The problem with the raloxifene is that you get more hot flashes and you get more postmenopausal symptoms because it only supports the bone. The positive to it, of course, is you actually probably reduce your risk of developing breast cancer if you're on a serum. So, again, look at your patients, and you might have somebody who fits this profile, especially if they're low risk for for blood clots, they're very active, et cetera. These might be good drugs to think about to get them to not have that rapid drop. Calcitonin, I don't think I have one patient on calcitonin anymore, but when we're in training, we used to have them everywhere. And mostly they're just really used now short-term as a sub-Q injection because it does help reduce the pain of fracture. So sometimes we'll give them a daily or two or three time a week injection for the first few weeks until we start them on their main therapy. Basically, the big advantage is there are no GERD issues. They can help with acute pain. They don't have any renal issues. You can get nasal calcitonin. So if you have a patient who really refuses everything and, you know, they've read everything that Dr. Phil and Oprah says, they're not going to take their medication, you might be able to convince them at least do this. The big disadvantage is they don't do anything for non-vertebral fractures. They're really only for vertebral fractures. So it's better than nothing, but, you know, basically we have better drugs now. Bisphosphonates basically are very low cost now. You can get them both generically, IV and PO. You can give them weekly, monthly, daily, and even yearly now. They're very effective. But they do have side effects of GERD, et cetera, but one nice thing is that they don't have any of the hormone side effects that you're concerned with the estrogen. They're not going to cause blood clots and hot flashes. They're not going to increase your risk of malignancies such as breast cancer. But the disadvantage is that the oral forms frequently cause GI upset. They cause esophagitis. They're not recommended for renal patients with GFRs less than 30. Now, I will make one proviso here since we have a nephrologist in the office, is I can show you data from Paul Miller that shows you that the oral bisphosphonates are not dangerous to patients with renal disease. The IV ones are, because they can be very toxic because you're giving this dose very quickly. But there's plenty of evidence that patients with class 4 renal disease do fine with bisphosphonates. And the reason for that is that the absorption of an oral bisphosphonate is incredibly low. You only absorb 0.5% of the pill. That's it. So that's why you have to be very consistent and meticulous about taking your pills, because they don't have much efficacy if you're not basically perfect with them. So you're absorbing such a tiny amount, the chances are you're not going to hurt the kidneys. But if you give IV reclast, you give IV pimidronate, you can really mess somebody up very badly. I always do, as a rule, and this is not recommended, but this is something I do in the practice, is if I do have somebody on IV zoledronic acid, is what I do is I will have them get a creatinine 2 weeks after I give them the infusion. And if it bumps, I will never give them that drug again, okay? And I think that's just a good rule. Now, the manufacturer doesn't recommend that because they say most people usually are okay, but, you know, I don't think that's cool. So if they bump, I just don't do it again. So that's just part of our protocol. Potential risk of ONJ may be higher with the IVs. And, of course, esophageal malignancies, who knows? But, again, not a cool thing if they have oral bisphosphonates. So just avoid them in that situation. So these are some other pearls. Boniva, and I see a lot of people using Boniva, is it does not reduce the risk of hip fractures and it does not reduce the risk of non-vertebral fractures. Personally, I think that, you know, the abandronate probably shouldn't be used unless they can't tolerate the alendronate. Alendronate really has the best track record, has the best efficacy. It's the cheapest one. Okay, but people don't want to take it because of bad publicity. But this stuff just doesn't work as well, okay? And that's really the problem. So you might use it more for people who have gastrointestinal complaints and they don't want to take something stronger. Then you might want to switch to this, but this should not be your first choice, okay? You know, convenience is a cool thing because you can take it, you know, once a month, but that's really not the name of the game. It's to have efficacy first, then convenience. Patients with upper intestinal issues, you can also give this delayed-release residronate now, so you can actually take a bisphosphonate with food. Remember I told you the absorption is really lousy, okay? But what they did was they coated this, and basically it doesn't break down until the smaller intestine, and what it does is that the carrier in it actually helps you absorb the residronate. And what's interesting is the absorption of residronate is actually 2 and 3% with the actual delayed-release pill, whereas the old-fashioned pill is only about half to 1%. So it actually probably absorbs a little bit better. But the problem is it's more expensive, okay? But again, it's a good oral therapy. Oral therapies basically reduce the risk of fracture by about 50% in the vertebral spine, but IV therapies reduce it probably 70%. So IVs are probably more effective. You don't want to use the oral therapies in patients that have Barrett's esophagus. Okay, now this is a compliance curve, and basically what it's telling you is that unless your compliance is 75% or better, and probably closer to 90%, you're not getting that much efficacy of a bisphosphonate. Oh, I decided to take it every other week. It's like not taking it at all, okay? So anti-resorptive biologics, denosumab, Prolia, very popular now, twice a year shot, sub-Q, basically reduces risk of vertebral hip fractures, about the same rate as the zoledronic acid. And it's very easy to administer, has no renal toxicity or GI toxicity, but it is much more expensive. The anabolic therapy is a teriparatide. We like to use this basically as our biggest gun. So it's limited to basically 2 years of treatment. The reason is that there's a black box warning that talks about osteosarcoma. But to tell you the truth, they have a registry, and they've been following this, and they have not seen an increased incidence versus placebo. And only 2 or 3 cases have been reported when the natural incidence in the population is actually higher than the reported rate right now. So this probably doesn't seem to be an issue, but the FDA still has a 2-year limit on it, okay? The other issue is it's self-injected, and it's very expensive. So, you know, so some patients find it, especially with these Medicare plans, not covering much and higher copays, they don't want to cover it. So what are the future therapies? Sclerostin inhibitors, which are basically going to make even things like Prolia look like water, and cathepsin K. The cathepsin K inhibitors, unfortunately, seem to have a lot of side effects. These are going to be oral pills. They're going to be kind of like your nibs. So the cool thing about it is it's not going to be so expensive to produce. But the problem is when you hit cathepsins, what you do is you hit a whole bunch of other molecules at the same time, so there are more other issues that people are concerned about, other side effects. The sclerostin inhibitors are probably the ones that are going to come out. And the last thing we didn't talk about is cycling. Some people are using cycling therapy where you actually give people denosumab, and then what you do is you hit them with parathyroid hormone once a week. And what they can actually show numbers that actually double the bone growth in either of the therapies by themselves. And that actually is fairly cost efficient because you're using basically a Forteo pen or teriparatide pen over 30 weeks rather than 1 month. So, you know, it becomes more efficient. So I only maybe have 1 or 2 really bad cases on that, but that's all truly experimental. And, you know, you can find the articles. Dr. Felicia Cosman does most of this stuff in New York, and you can find her articles regarding that. So what are the current controversies? Bisphosphonates basically, non-bisphosphonates basically disappear rapidly after discontinuation. So in other words, if you stop Prolia, and you've been on it for 2 years and you stop it for a year, all of your bone gains by the end of the year that you're off are gone, okay? Because the drug is in, it's out. It's basically an antibody, hits a receptor. Once it's gone, it's gone. Okay, so you have to have something to do afterwards. So when to stop these drugs is not sure. The only good thing is with the Freedom data, it's showing that even at eight years now, that the bone densities continue to go up. Whereas bisphosphonates, they seem to plateau a little bit after 5 years. The bisphosphonates, since they do have a residual effect, then you might be able to discontinue them for a period of time. But the patients who are at high risk of fracture should probably continue therapy. And again, this is what I want you to remember. And when you see patients coming from my office and you say, that darn Baca, you know, he still has you on the Fosamax. Well, you know what? If they have a minus 4 bone density and that's your most appropriate drug, it's absolutely insane to take them off. Because within a year, their bone density is going to drop. And I'm seeing a lot of patients coming in with fractures now who stop their drugs. Why? Because Oprah said so, or Dr. Phil. And the problem with that is that it's a risk and benefits thing. The risk of ONJ, and these things are incredibly low, but the risk of a fracture is incredibly high for certain patients. And remember, the risk of mortality is high. No one's ever died of this jaw or tooth thing, but plenty of people have died from fractures. So if you see patients on therapy, basically there may be a reason for it. So don't just, glibly say, 5 years, you're out. We don't do that. That's old school. And if you really look at where that came from an editorial in the New England Journal. There's absolutely no data, no studies, nothing that suggests that you have to stop the drug at any particular time is based on your judgment. So, again, risks and benefits, okay? Just like being a real doctor. You don't follow the guidelines, risks and benefits. So as far as osteonecrosis of the jaw, the definition is exposed bone maxillofacial region for at least 8 weeks, okay, and no history of radiation to the craniofacial region. The problem is a lot of things can look like this, okay? And what's more interesting, and this is one thing I also want you to remember, this is not a new diagnosis. It was first described in 1850, okay, which means there was no Fosamax in 1850, okay? So it's seen with heavy metals. It's seen with infections. So potentially if you get a tooth abscess and you got pus in there and erodes a bone, you can get exposed gum tissue and bone. Is that a bisphosphonate, caused ONJ? Not really. So the problem is that anytime anybody has anything, the dentists love it because when they're putting implants in 100-year-olds and they say it doesn't take, well, it's not my fault. I mean, it should stick in a 100-year-old. Well, so it can kind of basically helps, justify their poor judgment and what they're doing to patients. So, what you want to do basically is just try not to, to be too aggressive with it. So you see it more after tooth extractions. It's more commonly seen in patients with cancer patients. And a German study basically looked at the patients who had basically diagnosed bisphosphonate ONJ, 97% of them were patients who had cancer, chemo. And I actually had the first patient. There were four patients reported and actually came out of NOVA in Florida. It was actually when the alarm bells went off many years ago. And one of them was actually one of my patients. And she had metastatic breast cancer that was even metastasized to her skull. Okay? She was on IV pimidronate and getting twice the maximum dose, cancer dose. So instead of getting it, I think, every other month, she was getting an IV dose every single month. And she did develop ONJ, but obviously if you didn't treat that, she probably would have died from her cancer. And she actually lived 10 years with a metastasis and did very well. So what's also interesting is if you look at IV reclast, okay, or pimidronate, there was one case of ONJ in the study, in the placebo, and there was one in the treated group. So technically speaking, if you look at the studies, of the IV bisphosphonate, you're again talking a very rare group because this is a different group than the patients that have cancer, okay? So the rate is estimated anywhere from 100,000, and there's some studies that don't dispute it entirely and say we're not even sure it exists unless the patient has cancer, okay? Because there is a placebo rate, but the dentists don't call you when a patient has exposed bone and they haven't been on anything. So we don't capture that data, so we have no idea how often it happens without the bisphosphonates. Okay, so again, no evidence-based guidelines, only expert opinion, and usually it's, usually the expert is Cohen and Cohen. So, usually they're just basically just covering their butts and, they'll do whatever they need to do. So risk is definitely felt to be higher with the IVs. and denosumab, but they're not seen with HRT. So if you have a patient who's concerned about this, maybe calcitonin, HRT, or serums might be appropriate for them. If they absolutely have bad dental issues and they don't want to take the medications, they're afraid of it, then that might be a way to go in. But again, these are not as effective drugs. Basically, you want to prevent a good oral hygiene, a regular dental visits, and you should withhold the drugs if they have dental extractions. Not so easy to do with reclass because it sticks around a long time, but you know, if they have denosumab, basically you wait until they hold for a period of time, get your tooth extracted, and then wait till it heals, and then basically you go back on the drug later. Okay, and don't restart until the dentist basically gives you the go-ahead and says they're healed. There was a white paper in 2004, and basically what they suggest is you interrupt it in severe cases. But I've had patients who've actually had this, and one of them had Wegener's disease, so I had him on very high doses of mycophenolate, and also he was on steroids. And make a long story short, healed very nicely with just dental rinses, antibiotics, and I actually put him back on a bisphosphonate years later because he's at high risk and he's doing fine on the re-challenge. You coordinate with the dental specialist, and basically, you have to look at the risk, especially cancer patients, of developing hypercalcemia, malignancy, or other, cancer-related issues if they stop the bisphosphonate, because if you take it away, they're basically, the metastatic disease is going to go crazy, okay? So atrial fibrillation, you may have heard this a while ago, maybe Dr. Orenberg, the issue was the cancer issues. The fibrillation issues. Basically, what happened was they looked at patients 10 years later and said, these patients 10 years later have more atrial fibrillation. So what's the number one cause of atrial fibrillation? Being 10 years older, okay? So they relooked at the data, and they said there is no risk of bisphosphonates in AFib. So if that comes up, that's old data. It does not exist. Ignore it, okay? Esophageal cancer and alendronate. Basically, there was a suggestion, but again, no evidence base, that you probably shouldn't be giving these to people who have Barrett's esophagus or, basically any bad esophagitis, common sense stuff. So what are the impediments to treating? Poor reimbursement for DEXA scanning. We used to get $300 for DEXA scans, now down to $35. Talk about deflation. It's a $150,000 machine. You got to put it in a room. You got to have a tech running. You got to pay for all this stuff and maintenance. We're losing money on doing bone densities, but we do it. Just like we use a stethoscope, it's something that you have to use. Even if you don't get paid for it, you're probably even losing money on it, but we do it because it's what you need to do. It's the right thing to do. But unfortunately, we don't have, appropriate governmental support for it. And also, the patients who are taking treatment is still poor. Maybe 15 to 20% of patients are actually appropriately treated. A lot of patients are not getting treatment. And then, of course, we have reimbursement issues with drugs, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, fear of medication side effects. I hear this constantly. I am worried that I am going to develop ONJ. And the answer that you should have to them is you're taking oral bisphosphonate. You don't have other risk factors. You're talking about 100,000. By the way, the risk of getting struck by lightning in Florida is 120,000. Okay? So, and always die to this tooth thing. So, in conclusion, the treatment's come a long way. We have a lot of treatment options. You don't want to forget treatment and early prevention. It has significant morbidity and mortality. And basically, we're not reaching on the majority of patients who should be treated. And this is very important for the residents. Basically, a patient who leaves a hospital with an old or new fragility fracture, where they see it on an x-ray, they came in a hip fracture, pelvic fracture, et cetera, you need to write in the chart what their osteoporosis treatment was prior to coming to the hospital. And you also need to make sure that they have appropriate follow-up treatment, because this is going to be one of your Medicare quality points at some point. They're going to say, what did you do to prevent Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so from coming back with another fracture? And that's very important. And in the future, you're going to be graded on this. And so you need to write in the chart somewhere. You don't necessarily need to institute treatment. It may not be appropriate to start at that moment. But you need to say, patient's going to come in, get a bone density, follow up with Dr. So-and-so or follow up with me, and I'm going to start him on blah, blah in the future. That's fine. It covers your butt. But you need to write something, okay? And, again, lack of insurance and government support basically exacerbates the problem. And, of course, Dr. Oz probably doesn't help any. And noncompliance is a big issue. And if patients aren't compliant, especially the oral ones, remember that curve I showed you? Basically, they don't work. They've got to be at least 90% compliant for these things to work at all, okay? And that's that. Questions?
Does treating with IV reclassed after a hip fracture enhance the healing?
They have data on that, and they actually purposely gave patients IV reclassed with hip fracture the reclassed while they were still in the hospital from the hip fracture, no healing issues. No healing issues. There were no problems with them healing. The benefit was...
Does it enhance healing?
Probably not, but it probably prevents further fractures. Now, you can make the argument, does teriparatide do that? The answer is we don't know, but I can tell you empirically a lot of us are using that. It's used off-label even for fracture repair now. You know, patients with bad vertebral fractures, pelvic fractures, we're using that. I've had patients, plenty of patients come with back pain, and they swear that after starting their, whether it's a bisphosphonate or teriparatide, that they feel like their back pain has gotten much better, even though they didn't have a diagnosed fracture, you know, within a few months of starting therapy. Any other questions? Okay.